morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December the 29th. And here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Mali's military government is denying reports that it hired Russian mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group. The group has been sanctioned by the European Union for rights abuses.
The joint statement said they deeply regret the transitional authority's choice to use already scarce public funds to pay foreign mercenaries instead of supporting its own armed forces and the Malian people.
The East African community has admitted the DRC as its seventh member to its bloc.
With regards to the admission in the East African community of the Democratic Republic of Congo, we look forward to the prompt conclusion of the remaining admission procedures.
That is Rwanda's President Paul Kagame. In Nigeria, the need for media literacy is gaining attention with the rise of fake news on social media. Those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, Mali's government is denying that it hired Russian mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group. The group has been sanctioned by the European Union for rights abuses. France and 15 other Western nations last week condemned what they said was Russia's deployment of Wagner fighters to Mali. Mali's transitional government says it only engaged with official Russian military trainers. Analysts weigh in on Russia's military involvement in Mali as French troops are drawing down in this report by Anne Risenbach from Bamako, Mali.
Mali's transitional government this month denied what it called a baseless allegations that it hired the controversial Russian security firm, the Wagner Group, to help fight Islamist insurgents. Western governments and UN experts have accused Wagner of rights abuses, including killing civilians, in the Central African Republic and Libya. The response came Friday after Western nations made the accusations, which Mali's military government dismissed with a demand that they provide independent evidence. A day earlier, France and 15 other Western nations had condemned what they called the deployment of Wagner mercenaries to Mali. The joint statement said they deeply regret the transitional authority's choice to use already scarce public funds to pay foreign mercenaries instead of supporting its own armed forces and the Malian people. The statement also called on the Russian government to behave more responsibly, accusing it of providing material support to the Wagner Group's deployment, which Moscow denies. The Mali government acknowledged what it called Russian trainers were in the country. It said they were present to help strengthen the operational capacities of their defense and security forces. Ali Tunkarda is director of the Center for Security and Strategic Studies in the Sahel, a Bamako-based think tank. He says it's hard to tell if the Russian security presence is military or mercenary, but regardless, would likely be supporting rather than frontline fighting. This could allow the Malian army to have victories over the enemy that will be attributed to them, says Tunkarda, which was not the case with the French forces. He says the second advantage is that the victories over the extremists could allow Mali's military to legitimize itself. We must remember, says Tunkarda, that one of the reasons for the forced departure of President Keita was that the security situation was so bad. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, was overthrown in an August 2020 coup led by Colonel Assimi Goïta after months of anti-government protests, much of it over worsening security. Goïta launched a second coup in May that removed the interim government leaders, but has promised to hold elections in 2022. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has been pushing Mali's military government to hold elections. ECOWAS in November expressed concern over a potential Wagner Group deployment to Mali after unconfirmed reports that the military government was in talks with the mercenary group. Popular protests in Bamako have called for French forces to leave Mali, and last year some protesters were seen calling for Russian ones to intervene. Since French forces first arrived in Mali in 2013, public opinion on their presence has shifted from favorable to widely negative. The French military has been gradually drawing down its anti-insurgent Operation Barkhane forces from the Sahel region. French forces this year withdrew from all but one military base in northern Mali, saying the Malian armed forces were ready to take the lead on their own security. But analysts say one consequence of the French leaving is that the Malian army is seeking other partners. Boubacar Salif Chouardé is director of AfriGlobe Conseil, a Bamako-based development and security consulting firm.
Cette coopération
Official Russian cooperation would be very advantageous for the Malian army in terms of supplying equipment, he says. Charity says Mali and many African countries, notably the Central African Republic, have concluded that France does not play fair in terms of delivering arms. Every time these states ask for weapons, he says, either there's an embargo or there's a problem in procuring these weapons. Charity says Russia can provide these weapons without constraints, and it's precisely that which interests Mali. In September, Mali received 4 military helicopters and other weapons bought from Russia. The Malian transitional government's statement Friday did not elaborate on what the Russian trainers would be doing in Mali. When asked for comment, a government spokesman would not elaborate and referred questions to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which does not list any contact numbers on its website. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
The East African community has admitted the Democratic Republic of the Congo into the 6-member community bloc. East African heads of state held a virtual summit last week that paved the way for prompt admission into the bloc that was formed in 2001. Eugene Uwimana has more details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
The 18th Extraordinary Summit of Heads of State of the East African Community approved the process of the admission of the Democratic Republic of Congo into the bloc. Yoweri Museveni is the president of Uganda.
I'm very happy today we approved the process for the admission of the Democratic Republic of Congo into the community. This is because Congo is really part of East Africa historically, especially the eastern part of Congo. They speak Swahili. They are similar to our tribes here. And it is colonialism which had kept Congo in another arrangement.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame said that DRC may be a great hand in handling COVID-19 challenges in the region.
Rwanda welcomes the progress made with regards to the admission in the East African community of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We look forward to the prompt conclusion of the remaining admission procedures.
DR Congo joining the ESC economically means a lot for the bloc. It will open the corridor from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, as well as north to south. Experts say DR Congo's population of 92 million also has the potential to contribute to expanded market and investment opportunities, which can make this regional bloc a great influencer on the continent. This is Samia Suluhu Hassan, president of the United Republic of Tanzania.
We all know the importance of DRC joining our community, as all partner states have long and close cooperation by either bordering or having trade relationship, which will enhance prosperity of our people and the region.
Uhuru Kenyatta, president of Kenya, who is currently the chair of the East African Community, said the application of DRC shows that the bloc is doing well and that gain has to be sustained.
I consider this as a testament of not only the success of the East African Community, but also the opportunities that remain untapped. This is also an affirmation of our efforts to deepen integration and widen cooperation.
Currently, the East African Community is made of 6 countries: Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya, and South Sudan. The procedure for admission of DR Congo entails 4 stages: a verification exercise, negotiations with the country on its admission to the ESC directed by summit, eventual admission, and the final deposition of the instrument of acceptance of the terms of admission by the country within 6 months of its admission to the community. If all goes well, the ESC Extraordinary Summit in April 2022 will welcome DRC into the bloc. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And still in East Africa, as the year comes to an end, Uganda is expected to lift measures introduced about 2 years ago to contain the rapid spread of COVID-19 in the country. Some analysts say they worry that the government has not done enough to sensitize the population on the plan to fully reopen the economy. They also say the government ought to have given businessmen some kind of stimulus after many days of their shops closure. Reporter Mugume Davis Wakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
In his last address to the nation on matters regarding COVID-19, Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni said he will fully open the economy at the beginning of next year.
The agreement is that the vaccines are now here. Please go and be vaccinated. If you don't go, we shall open the economy all the same. We shall open. And if you get into problems, don't say the government did not tell me.
Political economy lecturer Nsanji Siraj says this message can be misleading. He says the government should do more to sensitize citizens so they can better be prepared when the economy is fully opened.
They think that the government is not fully committed to the full reopening of the economy. So they think that maybe government is just trying to act them to see what are they up to. They haven't developed that confidence and belief that this time around government is ready to open up the economy.
Nsanji is also concerned that the government has not given small and medium-sized businessmen some stimulus so they can cope with the effects brought about as a result of 2 years of shutdown.
In the circumstances that the government has not done that one, we are likely to open up, but again, the demand side of the economy will be very low and very weak. Once the demand supply is very weak and very low, the industrialists and producers or manufacturers will not get it right, because you need all these people to demand for goods and services in order to stimulate production and stimulate manufacturing.
Julius Mukunda, the head of Civil Society Budget Advocacy Group, or CSBAG, a coalition of civil society organizations that advocate for prudent public finance management practices in Uganda, says opening the economy is long overdue.
We are really looking forward to opening up the economy, especially the night economy, where the entertainment industry can benefit more. We believe that the curfew also is a stumbling block to many people who have been making money in the evening. And as such, I think opening up the economy definitely will boost the incomes in the country, will increase trade activities, but also will open up employment.
Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni is expected to address the country this week on the way forward regarding fully opening of the economy. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. In Nigeria, the need for media literacy is gaining attention with the rise of fake news on social media. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha brings us this report on a media literacy training intended to equip young people in Nigeria with the skills to fact-check and fight misinformation online in Africa's most populous nation.
Concerns about fake news on social media has dominated debates in Nigeria over the years. In 2018, the Nigeria police said false information and provocative images on Facebook contributed to killings in Plateau State, an area affected by ethnic violence then.
It has actually been said by some wise people that if there's going to be a third world war, it may be instigated by fake news.
Ken Okere works in Nigeria as a journalist and media trainer. For 3 days, he worked with young Nigerians on digital fact-checking and countering misinformation online. He says young people need media literacy to navigate the murky waters of the country's active and growing digital media landscape.
The focus on young people is because they are the most active users of social media and digital tools of communication. So it is important to catch them young so that they understand the impact that sharing information, accepting everything they see, and influencing others to accept the same thing through sharing, the impact that can make. The biggest takeaway in a training like this is how active these young people are, how hungry they are for this media literacy, how eager they are to join the army of fact checkers.
Is that a fact for our opinion?
Yeah.
heard about misinformation and fact checking, but I don't really know the detail. So coming for this training has actually put me on the right path.
Hadiza Babacher is a student at the Nigeria Institute of Journalism in Lagos. She is one of dozens of young Nigerians who have gathered here in Lagos for the media literacy training.
I now know the steps to follow and the tools to use and also the difference between what is a fact and opinion. So I think I will do a better fact check because I've been equipped with that knowledge.
The 3 days training in Lagos held in partnership between the West Africa Broadcast and Media Academy and the U.S. Consulate in Lagos. Stephen Ibele is the public affairs officer at the U.S. Consulate General in Lagos. He says the rise of social media has unfortunately seen the rise of misinformation and fake news, hence the need for digital media literacy for young Nigerians.
And it's very difficult to call out every single fake story or every single opinion versus fact. And so media literacy is at the core of really giving the power to the individual to discern what is fact versus opinion. So these are the skills that we're giving young people who are especially susceptible because they are the ones using all of these online social media tools. And so it really is almost like a vaccination, almost like an inoculation against this scourge, against this disease, if you will, of misinformation and disinformation and fake news.
Research indicates that African audiences perceive that they are exposed to fake news about politics on a fairly regular basis and that the public trust in the media is especially low in Nigeria. By building the capacity of young Nigerians to verify content online, the Media Literacy Project aims to minimize the scope and impact of false information online. This is Samuel Okocha for VOA News in Lagos, Nigeria.
And just like Nigeria, Kenyans are also concerned that thousands of social media users in the country may be using platforms like Twitter to spread fake news. In October, Kenyan cybersecurity engineer Brian Obilo, a specialist in cybersecurity, resilience, awareness, and disinformation, co-authored a report titled Inside the Shadowy World of Disinformation for Hire in Kenya. The report uncovered a network of Kenyan Twitter influencers who were being paid by political operatives to launch online disinformation attacks targeting activists and members of the country's judiciary intended to undermine their work on contentious political issues of the day. I spoke to him via phone from Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
So for some of the influencers, some of them commercialize their following. So we have seen a lot of influencers get into paid partnerships with multiple brands in order to sort of just boost their career forward and stuff like that. Others can use it for social activism. Others are using it to amplify key social justice issues that are happening. And also for politicians, they're using their following to sort of promote or advance their agendas and whatnot. So it just depends on who the influencer is and what they intend to do.
This report that you co-authored says that, you know, shadowy financiers have deployed an army of Twitter influencers to coordinate digital information campaigns in favor of either a government, like in this specific case, a government-backed constitution amendment bill that is popularly known as BBI or was known as BBI, Building Bridges Initiative. Who are these financiers and are there other similar campaigns against government initiatives or bills in parliaments or even politicians?
Yeah, I think that's a question we receive a lot. So one of the sources that talked to us told us that first of all, they organize some of this disinformation. They coordinate some of this disinformation campaigns through the use of WhatsApp groups. And then once they hit the, you know, KPIs, then they receive their money through the mobile platform M-Pesa. So the people that are probably paying them are middlemen and middlemen and middlemen. So it's very, very hard to really trace that money and get the right people who are sort of financing the disinformation campaigns themselves. But at the end of the day, the most important question you can always ask yourself, and without a rhetorical question you can ask yourself, is who stands to benefit the most by sort of amplifying the Building Bridges initiative, and also at the same time pushing dissenting voices, or rather opposing voices, away from the platform. So it's very, very hard to answer that question, but that's how you can put it, like, who stands to benefit from it?
Okay, so whoever benefits is the one who's most likely paying, but it's very hard to trace the money directly to them.
Yes, exactly.
Are there any local laws that they're breaking by engaging in disinformation campaigns?
So in Kenya, we have the Computer Misuse and Cybercrimes Act that essentially forbids you from publishing false information. So it's not very clear, because of the nature of the disinformation they're spewing, whether they're breaking any laws. And also some of the disinformation we saw may constitute to maybe libel and defamation, especially the ones that the five judges of the High Court received. Some of the attacks they received may constitute to libel and this. So it's not very clear which laws they are breaking per se, but I guess it may depend on a case-by-case basis of every disinformation campaign and the exact content of what they were pushing out there.
Does, you know, we know in the US, Twitter actively last year was blocking accounts that were engaged in disinformation campaigns, whether it's against COVID vaccines or whether it was political campaigns. Has there been any such initiative in Kenya where Twitter has actually gone as far as blocking or deactivating an account for engaging in that type of activity?
Yeah, so one thing I can mention is that when we reached out to Twitter with this, they first of all thanked us for bringing this to their attention. And they conducted their own internal investigation, and their teams took action on just over 100 Twitter accounts that they believed had sort of violated their platform manipulation and spam policy. And while giving us feedback on the same, they told us that they had found one network of coordinated accounts which sort of link back to other accounts that were deactivated in 2020 last year. So this just shows the resilience of some of these groups that are conducting the disinformation campaigns. And even if Twitter takes action, they find ways in which they can set up more accounts to continue violating Twitter's platform manipulation and spam policy. So there is still so much more to be done, because from these campaigners' perspective, Twitter is a very lucrative platform, and it's very, very efficient for spreading disinformation because of some of the key features that the platform itself has, like its own trending algorithm and whatnot.
That was Brian Obilo, a Kenyan cybersecurity engineer, who's also a fellow with the Mozilla Foundation. And that's it for this Wednesday, December the 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important after news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.